08-40746, Bank of New York Trust Company versus official unsecured creditors. Let me just ask you a preliminary question, Mr. Engler, and because, you know, a lot of this case turns on what's appealable, what's equitable, and so on. Your clients have $530 million in escrow. You think in the current market there's any reasonable likelihood in the world that if we were to vacate the confirmation order, that your clients would ever get any more than that?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Shoot.
May it please the court, my name is Roy Englert and I represent the indenture trustee, which in turn represents the interests of the note holders. In non-technical terms, what this case comes down to is this. When lenders make loans secured by collateral, they bargain to be able either to foreclose on the collateral or to be repaid in full.
Or to be paid the indubitable equivalent.
Yes, and the bankruptcy court's key error, one of its many errors, but its key error was to take the phrase indubitable equivalent and say that that phrase is met when there is a sale free and clear of liens and the secured creditor has not been allowed to credit bid. Clause 2 of Section 1129B2A is the statute that specifically applies to sales free and clear of liens, and it gives creditors, secured creditors, the right to credit bid precisely so that they will not be forced to accept cash payments that in their view are too low. The key question of statutory interpretation here is whether a sale free and clear of liens without credit bidding and at a judicially determined value can in some way provide the indubitable equivalent of what Clause 2 provides. It cannot. The word indubitable is in the statute for a reason. Yes, judicial valuation is sometimes a necessary evil under the code.
Where do you have any case law support for this?
Yes, the Kent Terminal case is a support for the proposition that Clause 2, when it applies, is mandatory and all sales free and clear of lien must allow the right to credit bid. The Creamy My case, cited in both parties' brief, is support for a different proposition, which is that indubitable means free from doubt, so that the inexactitude of judicial valuation cannot provide the indubitable equivalent. The Ninth Circuit's Arnold and Baker Farms case is support for the same proposition. The inexactitude of valuation is notorious, as is reflected in the record of this case. Judge Schmidt could have found the timberlands to be worth any of a wide range of numbers, hundreds of millions of dollars apart, without having the finding be set aside as clearly erroneous. But it cannot be the case that giving the note holders just that number and denying them their right to credit bid provides the indubitable equivalent of the value of their secured claim. No case holds that cash in the amount of a judicially determined valuation of secured property is the indubitable equivalent of a secured claim.
That's because it's never offered in reorganization. Nobody pays cash in reorganizations. I mean, this is a very, as they said, they could have given you a note for the same amount and he could have crammed it down and you would have no argument today.
I don't think so, Your Honor, respectfully, because when you don't have a sale, as we do in this case, but you're giving a note under Clause 1, the 1111B election, if made, would allow the secured credit holder to have its entire claim be secured.
Yeah, and you didn't choose to make that. I think that's sort of a rabbit trail here.
With respect, Your Honor, let me suggest why it's not a rabbit trail. They argue hypothetically that they could have used Clause 1. The response that on the facts of this case, we in fact didn't make the election, is sort of not responsive because their point is a hypothetical point. They didn't offer us this note that they say they could have given us and then crammed down, and this whole case would have been very different if we were talking about a note that were then crammed down.
But you didn't even threaten to make the 1111B election. You took the position that it wasn't even applicable.
Only because there's a sale. The only reason it's not applicable is because there's a sale free and clear of liens. In a note situation, which doesn't involve a sale free and clear of liens, the 1111B analysis is different. And the way the statute hangs together is precisely our point, because you have the credit bid protection or you have the 1111B election protection. To say that we could go under Clause 1, where you don't have the credit bid protection, and you also wouldn't have the 1111B election provision because when we went under Clause 2, you didn't make the 1111B election, is a little bit of a sleight of hand. It's a little bit of a mismatch. In other words, indubitable equivalent means something very different from not clearly erroneous valuation. The first phrase, both in its original language and by its plain language and in its original usage by Judge Learned Hand in Murrell, means something all reasonable people would have to agree is completely compensatory. The second phrase means one among several competing resolutions of valuation testimony reasonable people don't agree on.
I still find it very peculiar that if the judge's valuation of the lien is correct, that offering cash to the secured creditor isn't the indubitable. I mean, the whole point of that is that nobody ever proposed ever to pay the secured creditor's cash.
Well, Your Honor, the cases under Clause 3 are mostly about substitute collateral. They're not about cash. But the point of Clause 2 is that the credit bid right protects against the possibility that we, the secured creditors, think the valuation is too low and we can put our money where our mouths is. This is exactly that case. We do think the valuation was too low, not clearly erroneous, that's not the issue, but we do think the valuation was too low, and we're prepared to back that up through credit bidding, and we were denied that opportunity. Let me turn to another point that cuts across many of the issues in this case.
Yes, and I trust at some point you're going to turn to the issue of equitable mootness, but
sure.
I'm not going to tell you how to do your argument.
Well, let me try, before getting to equitable mootness, to talk about another point that cuts across many issues in this case, including both indubitable equivalent and absolute priority. Somehow there was money available to pay the unsecured creditors of both PALCO and SCOPAC, even though the secured creditors of PALCO, namely Marathon, own $160 million of debt secured by just $110 million of PALCO assets, and as we all know, the secured creditors of SCOPAC, namely Bank of America and the note holders, own debt secured by the timberland and other assets that the bankruptcy court valued at far less than the debt they were owed. How can that be? How can money be left over for the unsecured creditors when all the assets of both companies aren't nearly enough to pay their secured debt? Every possible answer to that question is legally unsatisfactory. One answer, the answer in the red brief, is that Marathon and MRC simply overpaid for the assets. That answer implies that there is such a thing as a sale of an asset for more than its value, whereas the basic point of 203 North LaSalle, and for that matter of basic market economics, is that assets are worth what the highest bidder is willing to pay for them. So-called synergies, individual to a particular buyer, are part of the market, not some force outside the market with no bearing on value. In other words, to accept the contention that Marathon and MRC paid more than the judicially determined value of the assets is necessarily to call into question the correctness of the judicial valuation, at least to the extent of rendering it a dubitable rather than indubitable equivalent, but really in a way much more fundamental than that. Accepting the contention that MRC and Marathon overpaid for the assets they bought also blows up any contention that the plan complies with the absolute priority rule. There is no rule that allows junior classes to participate before more senior classes are paid in full just because some allegedly benevolent source of cash wishes to direct its money to them rather than to the secured creditors. Even in the heyday of the new value exception to the absolute priority rule before 203 North LaSalle, the most anybody argued was that old equity could itself buy into a plan with new value, not that creditors or strangers could bring in new money and distribute it however they like. The Third Circuit's Armstrong World Industry case, cited in our reply brief, soundly rejects any argument that junior interests can participate in violation of absolute priority just because a more senior class wishes to give up some of its money and bypass creditors in between.
Counsel, let me ask, on the security, the difference between the lien being on the timberlands as opposed to all the assets of SCOPAC. I don't see in the appellee's responses if they really challenge you on that, that your security interest was in all of SCOPAC, not just in the Timberlands, whatever that difference might be?
That's correct. And the whole reason, if I may, Judge Southwick, that SCOPAC was set up was to isolate all the assets held by SCOPAC so that money could be raised by lending with all those assets as collateral. It's what's called a special purpose entity in bankruptcy.
Understood, but to the extent we're talking about $700 or $867 million initially, whatever it was worth, and there is a dispute on that at the time of bankruptcy, 100%, it's like owning the stock, it's having like having a lien on the stock and all the assets is what you're saying the secured creditors had, and not just on whatever might be identified as timberlands.
Right.
All right.
Now, my time is drawing a little bit short, so let me say a few words about equitable mootness and remedies. First, let's get out of the way the contention that Section 1127B governs this issue. Section 1120C forbids a proponent of a plan to propose modifications after substantial consummation, and one of the leading cases on that is the U.S. Brass case from this court. It is not a limitation on what appellate courts can do. When Congress wants to limit what appellate courts can do, it writes a statute like Section 363M, which specifically refers to what appellate courts can do. 1127B doesn't talk about appeals. And In re Mangese has some dicta that suggests that 1120C is relevant, and yet In re Mangese is the source of the three-part test that this court regularly applies to equitable mootness matters. If 1127B actually applied, substantial consummation would be dispositive by itself, and there wouldn't be any room for the three-part test. So it can't be that 1127B disposes of this appeal. Now, assuming this court agrees with us on the merits, there are definitely remedies it can impose. The remedy that best fits the wholesale illegality of this plan is reversal of the entire confirmation order with directions to have the indenture trustee return the money, have Bank of America return the money, have Newco and Townco return the money to MRC and Marathon, and reconstitute Palco and SCOPAC until a lawful plan can be confirmed. The timberlands would be worked, but regulators would be worked with, the mill would run, and environmental obligations would be complied with as they have been in the past. If the court thinks that that solution goes too far, the court can make sure that the parties who proposed an unconfirmable plan and then rushed to consummate it bear the consequences of their actions. The noteholder's lien on the timberlands can be reinstated, junior to the exit financing, essentially as was done in the PW case, also known as the Clear Channel case, recently decided by the Ninth Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel. More than 20 years ago, footnote 1 of this court's Sun Country decision indicated that lien reimposition is an available remedy that defeats equitable mootness.
And then it denied it.
In that, on the facts of that case, yes, because there was indubitable equivalence in that case.
As I understand that footnote, 200 acres totally on which the lien initially existed, reinstate on 35, whatever that reason is, I didn't see a lot of facts set out in the opinion. But in there, apparently, the court found it might be possible, but ended up not being, on some segregable part of the overall original asset that would not be undermining the bankruptcy, you could reinstate the lien. Would you agree that's what Sun Country is talking about? And I don't see that we have such a situation in our case.
Well, I don't think that footnote of Sun Country turned on the partial nature of the reimposition of the lien. I think it just said generally lien reimposition is an available remedy that affects only parties before the court. The doctrine depends mainly on the effects on parties not before the court, and reimposing our lien would affect parties who are all before the court. So I mean, Sun Country is on its facts a little bit different from this case, but I don't think there are factual differences that matter. Let me add, MRC and Marathon are parties before this court, and they could be ordered to pay to the note holders the $28 million unlawfully diverted to unsecured creditors, plus the $12 million of intercompany debt that was canceled under Section 4.10.2 of the plan. And the easiest remedy to impose, but it's hardly a complete remedy, is to strike the exculpation clause, which is illegal for the reasons set out in our brief, and not at all a standard provision as appellees contend.
Like I thought reserve. It was.
I'm sorry?
I thought it was. If we deny relief in this case, on what basis could you sue the note holders? Why do you care about the exculpation clause at that point?
Well, for one thing, the Unsecured Creditors Committee supported a plan that was not in the best interest of the unsecured creditors. It was riddled with conflicts of interest.
You don't have standing to pursue that.
We'd have to test that in another lawsuit, Judge Jones.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go too far in testing that. I mean, frankly, you know, there's a lot that you argue here that's interesting. You didn't mention the gerrymandered classes, for instance. But you know, my experience in bankruptcy was that every principal has a price, and they offered you a price, and it's a, you know, in the current market, it's not too bad, and it looks as if you're just trying to gain leverage to renegotiate.
Well, except, Judge Jones, we are putting our money where our mouths is. We the indenture trustee is holding the $513.6 million to return so that there is an opportunity to get this right. We were prepared to credit bid in an amount far in excess of $513.6 million. There was
well, under what circumstances could you, if the judge had just called it a sale rather than a quote, reorganization, then you would have elected 1111B, is that what you're saying?
No, 1111B is unavailable.
Precluded there.
In the case of a sale.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying that in connection with a different argument, but I am saying that we do believe that these assets were and are worth more than what the judge valued them at. We do believe we didn't get the indubitable equivalent, and we were denied our right to credit bid. We do believe the plan was completely unconfirmable because there was no impaired dissenting class without gerrymandering classes. So we do think the plan was fatally flawed in many different respects.
And what about the argument that you waived seeking these narrower remedies on appeal because you never sought them below?
Well, Your Honor, when a case is held not to be equitably moot, remedies such as lien reimposition are always different from the remedies that were sought below. What was sought below was always non-confirmance of a plan. So the doctrine of equitable mootness and the doctrine of remedies are both equitable doctrines that call on a court to exercise its remedial discretion and say what can be done now that certain events have happened in the real world. You don't ask for the remedies that you asked for before those events happened.
Well, although it might have affected Judge Schmidt's decision on whether to grant a stay. In other words, if you had said all we want is to hold in abeyance the question of the lien pending appeal and let these other things happen, then he might have looked at the relief on the stay differently.
Sure, but that wasn't all we wanted, and indeed we don't think we even got what we were entitled to. This plan, by its own terms, defines effective date in terms of a final order. It defines final order in terms of a non-appealable order. So we actually thought we were entitled to a stay of the whole thing because their very own plan says we can't consummate until the appeal is completed.
All right, so you have time for rebuttal. Mr. Brilliant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Alan Brilliant on behalf of the Appellees. I'm joined at counsel table by Brad McLean of the U.S. Department of Justice and Mr. Paul Pascuzzi and Michael Neville, counsel to the California State Agencies. Before turning to the merits, I want to address the dispositive threshold issue that Your Honor raised, that this appeal is equitably moot and should be dismissed. Under Fifth Circuit precedent, an appeal from confirmation of a bankruptcy plan is equitably moot when the plan is so substantially consummated that it would be inappropriate to order relief, even though a live dispute remains. The test for equitable mootness is far more readily met than the test for constitutional mootness. I think based on the answers that you heard from the appellants, I think they're confusing constitutional mootness and equitable mootness to some extent. And the test here is simply what the court should do rather than what the court theoretically could do.
Well, let me just say that the background on equitable mootness is a little peculiar to me because, of course, 28 U.S.C. 158D was passed for the purpose of facilitating appellate review in bankruptcy cases. And as you know, I was on the commission which recommended that by a unanimous vote. And here you have, there's not much case law on 158D, but here you have Judge Schmidt agreeing that there ought to be appellate review of this, and then denying a stay, and then you fellows, some game is played with the effective date, which maybe you can explain to me how he issued an effective date inconsistent with the plan, And then you fellows have done about as speedy a job of trying to undermine our appellate review as I've ever seen in nearly 25 years on the bench. So what's equitable about that situation?
Okay. Let's start first, Your Honor, with the statute on the direct appeal. There's nothing, as Your Honor knows, there's nothing in the legislative history that says that direct appeal would any way change the requirement for getting a stay or any way change the equitable mootness standards. The equitable mootness standards are prudential standards, you know, to protect, reliance by third parties and finality of bankruptcy court orders. So I don't think the fact that there's a direct appeal statute changes the obligation of parties to get a stay. Obviously, it skips the district court, but it doesn't necessarily create any change in the mootness doctrine. That's number one. The second thing is, Your Honor, the evidence is absolutely clear that the Palco debtors were completely out of money. There was no way that these companies could have continued to finance their business operations if there wasn't an immediate closing. I point to two places in the record on that issue, Your Honor. The Dean affidavit, which is an exhibit to the mootness doctrine, or mootness motion rather, and also the findings of fact and conclusions of law by the trial court judge, by the bankruptcy court judge, in connection with the stay hearing. It was very clear that if the closing didn't occur, there would be no ability for this company to ever reorganize. And consequently, there was no inequitable conduct on behalf of anybody here in rushing to close. It was necessary to close.
What about the distinction between the effective date and what the judge ordered?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, with respect to that issue, all the parties assumed that the plan would close immediately after the confirmation order was granted, unless a stay was put into effect. All the parties on the appellee side thought that, and all the parties on the appellant side thought that. And in fact, when the appellants sought a stay in front of the bankruptcy court, the district court, and then in front of this court initially, they said that the plan would close immediately if a stay wasn't granted. It was only after all of the stays were denied at all courts, including this court, that they then went back to the bankruptcy court and said, no, the language in the confirmation order, which changes the definition of effective date, which was agreed to by the appellants, in the form of the confirmation order, that somehow was drafted in a way that it couldn't close until after a full appellate review.
Well, it said the effective date would be after appellate review was concluded, right?
Right, and then it said in the confirmation order itself, it says that this is a initial caps final order. It said it would not close until it was a final order, and it said in the confirmation order, which they agreed to, that it was a final order. And Judge Schmidt, they argued that we couldn't close. We went back to Judge Schmidt. Judge Schmidt issued, another opinion, which is in the record, and he indicated that it was his intention when he put the words final order that the transaction would close immediately, given all of the issues. And the appellants were stopped from raising the argument that it wasn't appropriate to have an effective date, because they had previously said in all of their pleadings that when they sought a stay, that the effective date would occur as soon
They're
as the stays apply.
That is the worst argument in your whole brief, and you know it. So please, it might have been that the effective date, there is some legal argument why the effective date isn't what it says it is in the plan, which is after all appeals are concluded.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, but there may be, but it's not because they were representing what the consequences would be of not granting a stay, because they were, arguably accurate.
Yes, Your Honor. The confirmation order changed the definition in the plan by saying that this order is a final initial cap
I don't
order.
See how final order. Well, okay. Your Honor,
in the plan itself. It talks about the fact that the plan won't close until it's a final order, and that's the issue on the effective date. is the appellant's contention that final order.
Well, what if the judge misread the plan? I mean, how can the judge misread, you know, I mean, I'm not saying he did, but I mean, arguably, he may have misinterpreted the plan.
No, it's the confirmation order trumped the plan. That's what it says with respect to this issue, and specifically
change.
How can
the confirmation order trump the plan when the plan is something that everybody votes on?
Well, the only with respect to, you know, this one issue as to whether or not, you know, the effective date had occurred. And that issue on the effective date, as Your Honor, I'm sure knows, the appellants, you know, sought a stay on that issue as well, and it was denied, you know, by this court, and that allowed the closing,
I don't want to take up all your time on this, but I would draw your attention to an en banc dissent that Justice Alito wrote on equitable mootness in the Third Circuit, and the case is Continental Airlines, 91 F. 3rd, 553, and so, you know, there's a lot to this issue, I'm afraid.
Your Honor, I think there is a lot to the issue of equitable mootness, but I think it's clear that in this court, in this circuit, an appeal from a confirmation order, you know, is equitably moot if you meet a three-part test that was set out in Manges, that the appellants failed to obtain a stay, even the, you know, and that's absolutely clear here.
Sun Country, I mean, but Sun Country pretty, I mean, it says what it says, albeit quite tersely in footnote one, that when you're talking about lien stripping, you have jurisdiction. We have jurisdiction.
Your Honor, first of all, Sun Country, you know, was before Manges. Second, it's in dicta, it's in a footnote. Third, it's very different than the situation here. There, using the indubitable equivalent test, they were crammed down.
Well, we're not, yes, but you're using the, you're trying to, that puts the cart before the horse, because that assumes that their argument has no merit and then uses that to say it's moot. Mootness is whether we can adjudicate it. They may be right or wrong on the merits.
No, Your Honor, mootness is whether you should adjudicate it. This is not constitutional mootness where you can come up with any particular issue. The question is whether, because of prudential concerns, the court should adjudicate it. If
and an argument that a lien has been stripped in violation of bankruptcy law, and behind that stands the Constitution, is to me a pretty serious argument, which is also, it was also serious to the BAP and PW Holdings.
Right. Well, the PW Holdings case is a 363 sale. It is not a plan of reorganization. And there, so you don't have the same level of third-party issues that would be involved. And the case, I believe, was, you know, decided wrongfully. And also, in that situation,
Judge Markell?
I believe he decided this one wrongfully, Your Honor. And I think that the key issue there, which is very distinguishable here, is there the lien holder just credit bid, and the mechanics lien was stripped. Here, parties came up with hundreds of millions of dollars of additional dollars. There's exit financing in the amount of $325 million from American Ag Credit.
Yeah, but suppose they had said, well, let's move into absolute priority here. Suppose they had said, we're injecting $600 million and $100 million is what we've already, you know, what we're already in hock for, $600 million, we're giving $300 on the Redwoods. Could they have confirmed that plan?
Your Honor, I didn't follow that.
You say they're injecting a bunch of cash. Of course they are. But the point is, are they fully paying off the claim on the Redwoods? Or does, under our law, does the lien holder have the ultimate right to say, I want my property back?
No, Your Honor, you got it absolutely right in your, questions to the appellants. Under the bankruptcy code, under 1129, B2A, you have three alternatives, one, two, or three is what the statute says. The statute doesn't say one, two, and if neither one or two applies, three. There is no absolute right to a credit bid under 1129 B2A, As Your Honor points out, there are no real authorities that say that there would be. And the language of 1129B2-1 makes it very clear that by giving them a note that that they have no right to credit bid. And in fact, Your Honor, they got the facts a little bit wrong here. The original plan that we put forward would have given them a note. They then complained that there was the value of the note because of the interest rate, and we substituted, and they did not make the 1111B2 election when there was going to be a note. They chose not to make it at that point, and they never raised the issue. And I agree with you, it's a rabbit trail we don't need to go down to on 1111B2. But
also,
they didn't.
Maybe you weren't quite finished with that, and I'll let you, but I want to pull you back just a moment to your to the test that we apply on equitable mootness. The position that seems to me, the fallback position, but maybe it's the primary one now, on mootness, is that there are certain matters of relief that we could enter. Among the things they have said is a second subordinate lien for the $200-plus million that they did not receive. Certain issues regarding release. Are you saying there is nothing? It does seem to me that equitable mootness is a potential consideration. Would you accept that if the plan itself is not being unduly, I'm trying to see what the language is, it's not being unduly disrupted, that we could find parts of the lower court order to be equitably moot, but not all of it, and that we could work along the margins on some of these matters that might not be as disruptive to the plan?
Only working along the margins and not modifying the plan as it affects the economic give and take.
What would a second lien do to the plan?
Well, a second lien, Your Honor, would put the company back in bankruptcy, presumably, especially if it was in the amount of $225 million. That would basically put the company back to the same level of debt that it had before it filed bankruptcy.
Okay.
It would also put the company's current debt in default. It would violate reps and warranties that were made to California agencies. But
you all knew when you were rushing to confirm this. So, I mean, this is a fairly novel situation where you're basically cramming down the first lien holder by saying, we're going to pay you this much cash and no more and let the bankruptcy court value it. Isn't that a fairly unusual situation?
Your Honor, it is a little bit unusual to give cash, but it's not unusual to cram down first lien holders. And clearly, there would be, I don't believe.
Yes, but the problem is if you cram them down under one, provisions one or two, then they have their default right to take the property.
Under one, they do not have a default right to take the property, Your Honor.
They
would get a note with equal to the same judicial valuation.
But the judges are usually pretty careful about valuing notes, arguably speaking.
Well, Your Honor, but that valuation requires two things. One, you have to value the property. And then you have to put the right interest rate and terms on the notes to make them valuable.
Then they can do, and they can't do the 1111B election, right? Or they can?
Well, we believe they can. They were offered it. They never said that they couldn't make it.
Legally they could, though, right, under one?
Yes, and they could have under our plan. We offered them the right to do it.
But the point is, so there's something to what he says, though, that if you offer them a note, they can counter-move to take the property, to put the entire, to require the entire value be paid out in the note and not just the stripped down value of the lien, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So that's number one. So number one is if you had given them a note and they had made the 1111B election, it would have had to cover over $700 million.
It would have had the present value equal to the value of the property, but $700 million.
Correct. Under number two, they could sell free and clear, the judge would have to they'd have the right to credit bid. And then only number three is indubitable equivalent. So that's why it could be saying that you are using indubitable equivalent to do an end run around their right to credit bid under the other two sections. And that's why I asked if there are any other cases that deal with a cash out indubitable equivalent turning everything on valuation as this case is done.
Your Honor, the Zion case that we cite, you know, talks about giving cash. You know, the Crimmie May case, we believe, supports our position. And I believe that the Briscoe decision, in some respects, from the Fifth Circuit here, which talks about judicial evaluations and also the fact that or means or here, and there's, you know, three alternatives, I think also is supportive of our position.
Well, not on the facts, but on the...
Not on the facts, but on the law, Your Honor, and the interpretation of the statute.
Counsel, could you spend just a bit of time on the class gerrymandering?
Sure. You know, here, Your Honor, the you know, the bankruptcy court applied the, you know, the right law, looked at the you know, the two seminal cases in the Fifth Circuit, Greystone and Briscoe, looked to see whether or not there were a good business justification for separately classifying the claims.
Is there enough evidence, or what specific evidence is there to support the business justification that the court relied on?
There was a testimony from the chairman of MRC that that you know, this company, which operates in a you know, small town, actually a company-owned town, a town owned by Palco in rural Northern California.
Your time's running out. I know that testimony. That is a somewhat interested witness, though, is it not? But it was evidence that the court had. Is that basically what the court relied on?
Well, that, and in addition to that, Your Honor, the CEO of SCOPAC also testified. We cite to his testimony in the record where he says that paying substantial amount to these creditors would aid the success of the company, that certain of the critical vendors that the company identified earlier in the case had not been paid, and you know, confirmed the fact that there were a number of small vendors who needed to get paid.
Now, the trade vendors in Class A were all SCOPAC creditors, were they not?
That's right.
So where did the money come from that they were paid with?
Your Honor, it came from two places. One of the things that I think is misunderstood by the appellants is that in a bankruptcy case, you know, creditors very often, you know, leave money behind or do other things with their own collateral or get deals done. There were a number of reasons for doing that here. Marathon had a lien on the town, the cogeneration facility, and the mill. And if the timberlands were to have been foreclosed upon, and they would have lost the access to you know, those trees, it would have dramatically diminished the value of their other collateral. So they set aside some of the value that they would otherwise get in order to you know, pay some of these creditors. So that was number one. Two is MRC had $10 million a year in synergies that they would be able to exercise by you know, combining its operations with the operations of the timberland. So they were able, you know, based upon that, you know, to pay, you know.
MRC had every incentive to get in here and buy a competitor as cheap as possible, didn't it?
Well, of course they did, Your Honor. That's what everybody does. I'm not going to say that they didn't, but here there was a mini auction that occurred. There were a number of bidders that stepped forward. Harvard, the Nature Conservancy, Beale, Timberstar, a number of people came forward.
Well, now in your brief, you're saying that all those were not real bids, and there wasn't they didn't need an auction because there weren't any other real bidders in the ball game.
Your Honor, the papers. Cited by the appellants, you know, they say that the significant due diligence was done by all of those bidders.
But that's not what your brief says.
No, I'm saying
your brief says that the judge found that all those other bids were unfounded or, you know, just not worthy of consideration.
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, none of them came forward and made a bid that was greater than the MRC Marathon plan. But that doesn't belie the fact that there was a process here. That the termination of exclusivity, that the court required that parties who were interested, who wanted to work with the note holders, would get information to do due diligence.
I had one other question here, and that is, how did this case get filed in Corpus Christi?
Your Honor, it was before I got involved in the case. Ultimately, there was litigation about it, but the parent company of Palco was based in Houston, and they had some operations in Texas. We believe that the plan that the appeal is equitably moot, that the court, you know, for policy reasons, you know, should not accept the appeal and should dismiss it. To open up the floodgates here by modifying the plan would make it such that other parties would not feel, you know, comfortable in closing deals, which would cause companies that don't have capital to have to liquidate.
Let me just say that well, two things. Number one is, and I can get a brief reaction from you, that to me this just looks like a big, a very large scale single asset real estate case.
Your Honor, first of all, this court already ruled on the fact that it wasn't a single asset real estate case. That was, you know, brought up, and this court determined it was not. The company had $50 million of revenues, Scopac, 60 employees. It operated as an—
When did this court decide that? I'm sorry. I don't. I thought I had read the briefs.
Your Honor, I can give you the, you know, the date and the site in a moment. I left it at counsel table.
All right.
But so it's not a single asset real estate case. It had about $50 million of revenues, operated significant operations on their timberlands. It was also part of an integrated corporate group with its parent, Palco, which operated three mills, a cogeneration facility, and owned the town.
Well, and Palco was losing money hand over fist.
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And Palco had, I believe, over about 300 employees. This was a very large operation. Scopac sold significantly all of its, timber, to Palco, and so it's not a single asset real estate case in any stretch of the imagination. Also, Your Honor, there's a lot of regulatory and governmental, concerns here. Environmental concerns on the timberlands about,
Well, if nobody's cutting them, there's not, the concerns aren't very large. They might come into play into approving who is able to cut them.
Your Honor, I think it's more complicated than that. As you see in the papers, the debtors had, $13 million of backlog environmental remediation obligations that they had fallen behind on, which put waters and streams and fish and other wildlife in jeopardy, in danger. And from a mootness perspective, one of the things you should take in mind is that any kind of changing of the plan, which upset the success of the plan, will also have potentially large environmental effects. And also, as I mentioned earlier, If Your Honors, were to reinstate a lien such that, parties came in and expended new dollars.
All right. I just asked for your reaction on one issue, so that's sufficient, and we're giving you way over time. So.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, sir. Okay, Mr. Englert.
Thank you, Your Honor. Perhaps the single most important thing I can clarify on rebuttal is that when Mr. Brilliant refers to this company and losing money, he's talking about Palco, not Scopac. Scopac was a profitable company. And when Scopac was created as a special purpose entity in bankruptcy for the purpose of making assets available for collateral so that the company could get loans, the promise to the secured lenders was Palco's problems aren't going to be Scopac's creditors' problems. That's why Scopac was created. So when Mr. Brilliant says that from an equitable perspective, we should worry that Palco is losing money hand over fist, that's in violation of the basic premise on which money was lent to Scopac. Now, even so, in connection with the stay application, my clients offered to put up cash to help Palco with its cash flow problems while the appellate process ran its course under 28 U.S.C. 158D, and that offer was refused and didn't lead to the grant of a stay. But the idea that there is equity in rushing to consummate this plan because Palco was losing money ignores the separateness between Palco and Scopac, and is not in accordance with the facts in terms of our having offered to help Palco during the brief period. This case was in, from the petition date to the confirmation date was 18 months. It's been less than 3 months since the confirmation date, and here we are at oral argument in the Fifth Circuit. They really did rush, as the Chief Judge suggested, and that does bear on the doctrine of equitable mootness, which is, after all, a judge-made equitable doctrine. To the extent anything is of constitutional dimension here, it's the need to have uniform bankruptcy laws, as stated in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, and as carried out by 28 U.S.C. 158D in its recent amendments. If a single bankruptcy judge can break promises to secured lenders in the way that we respectfully suggest was done in this case, that will not be consistent with the need for uniform bankruptcy laws. It will not be consistent with 28 U.S.C. 158D, and it will affect the giving of credit in the United States.
Now, you say break which promises?
The promise that Palco's problems would not be Scopac's problems, and that they would be repaid in full or able to foreclose, subject only to such modifications as the bankruptcy code actually provides. Mr. Brilliant said a second lien would put the company back in bankruptcy, presumably. Well, presumably is not evidence. And the amount of debt that the reorganized debtor would carry if you let the reorganization plan stand but did reimpose a second lien would be far less than the $740 million Scopac used to carry, because there would be the $325 million American Ag credit exit financing, and there would be the $226 million reimposed lien for my clients. That's almost $200 million less debt than they used to carry, so it's not a recreation of the exact same situation. Equitable mootness, to my knowledge, has never been applied to lien stripping, never, whether under 363 or under 1129. And Mr. Brilliant points out that PW was a 363 case, not an 1129 case. 363 has a statutory mootness provision. 1129 does not. It's just the judge-made doctrine of equitable mootness. So the fact that PW was a 363 case meant Judge Markell, writing for the bankruptcy appellate panel, had more problems to get around than this court has to get around to reimpose the lien in this case. Also, the PW case is instructive on another point, and this gets away from equitable mootness and back to the merits. Section 363, the relevant subsection, has five alternative ways that it can be met. And the whole merits question before the bankruptcy appellate panel in PW was, if you can come within the literal terms of one of those subsections, but another subsection seems designed to deal with that section, can you make an end run around the more specific section through the more general section? The holding of PW, we think correctly reasoned, was that you cannot use the more general section to make an end run around the more specific section, so indubitable equivalent cannot be used to make an end run around number two, nor can clause one be used to make an end run around number two.
What do you do about this court's holding in Briscoe?
Briscoe was, if I recall correctly, a substitute collateral case. It was a different situation.
Well, I know, but it clearly said that the three subdivisions of 1129, A2, blah, 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 whatever it is, 1, 2, and 3 are not conjunctive, they're disjunctive.
And they are disjunctive. There's no question they're disjunctive, just as the subsections of 363F, I think it was, are disjunctive. But that doesn't mean that each one is applicable to every fact pattern. And certainly when we're talking about a sale free and clear of liens, which is what 2 is designed to cover, and when we know from the legislative history that Congress put the credit bid right in Clause 2 specifically because sales free and clear of liens are not supposed to be used to deprive secured creditors of their collateral without giving them the chance to put it to a market test, it would be a very strange holding that indubitable equivalent allows circumvention of that provision. Thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you.